You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Gloucester Crescent is a curving, leafy street tucked between Camden Town and Primrose Hill. It's unremarkable in many ways, unless you notice the lady in the van and the familiar-looking residents crossing the road. Written through the eyes of a growing child, this is the story of a very particular family and their circle of brilliant, idealistic and intellectual friends in London in the 60s, 70s and 80s. William Miller has written this new book following his life as he explores the back gardens and homes of his famous neighbours, attends dramatic rehearsals with his dad, Jonathan Miller, fails exams and gets bullied at school, gets drugs from the philosopher A.J. Ayer's wife, and tries to watch the moon landing with Alan Bennett. Quite an unusual childhood, I think you'll agree. Joining me live on the line is William Miller. William, good morning to you.
Good morning, Charles. What a brilliant choice of song, Our House by Madness.
Well, I just thought, you know, it's Camden, we're talking about houses, and they are North London boys, and you too are, if you like, a North London boys. I love the opening of the book where your father takes you up Primrose Hill and draws a line of where he's been and where you are.
Yes, and my father never went very far. I mean, the description I write at the beginning of the book is that my father would take us up Primrose Hill to explain to us that he'd never gone very far, and that his life had spent going anti-clockwise around Regent's Park and Primrose Hill, and starting at the very, very south side in Park Crescent, and ends up in the street, Gloucester Crescent, in 1961, and had never really, I mean, he travelled the world for work, but in terms of living somewhere, he'd never been very far from where he started.
And tell us a little bit about, well, we'll tell us a little about your parents in a minute, but Gloucester Crescent itself physically, because you tend to think of people, of, you know, famous people living in the, you know, in mansions here or there, or, you know, moving out to Surrey and commuting in. But Gloucester Crescent, it was a little bit different. It's almost like a village within the city.
It is, absolutely. And I mean, to just explain where it is, it's on the northeast corner of Regent's Park. So if you wanted to live in a residential street, it's about the closest you can get to London Zoo. And in 1961, it was considered really a sort of forgotten backwater, but with very, very large houses. It's a crescent, and behind it, a terrace called Regent's Park Terrace. And in 1961, my father was part of a group of people who had a very early success with their careers. My father was a comedian, or had been trained as a doctor, became a comedian, and partnered up with Alan Bennett, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore to do a very successful satirical comedy show called Beyond the Fringe. And my father's sort of friends from university and school had these sort of very early successes in their 20s and wanted to start a family and buy a house in sort of reasonable, decent-sized houses. And this was one place where they could afford to live, and was fairly central and close to the places they work, like the BBC or theatres or newspapers in the West End.
And I mean, what was it like then growing up with this unusual child? We think we call it unusual childhood because you know your father's Dr. Jonathan Miller. It was a 60s childhood, and for those of us who grew up in the 60s, they were anti-establishment. It was a new way of thinking.
Well, it was. I mean, the thing is that I mean, it was an incredibly, there's no question about it, it was an incredibly privileged upbringing. You know, they'd all been to public schools. My parents and their friends had all been to the very best private schools and had then gone on to go to Oxford and Cambridge. But they were part of that post-war sort of euphoria and promise that the Labour Party gave in the 1948 landslide of a new national health service, state education, and that things were going to be different. And I think they felt that up until that point, Britain was crippled by the sort of narrow-mindedness of the establishment. And my parents and their friends believed that they could change that through art, culture and humour. And so they were all very, very of the same mindset. And I suppose, yes, they were left-leaning. But the result of that was that they wanted their children to experience something they hadn't had. And that was a sort of more open-minded society, which basically meant we were all packed off to the local state schools.
Now, those of you who don't know the Camden area, I mean, it can be quite, shall we say, rough and ready. What was your experience like then when you know, did you say, can't I go to a nice prep school like you did, Father?
I didn't, because to be honest, what I sort of write about in the book is that it's not till much later that I realised there is an alternative. I mean, we were all sent to the local state primary school, which was very, it was around the corner and it was very cosy and nice. But we were very, very much sort of, we weren't liked by the teachers. It was a very, very left wing. In fact, some of the staff were considered themselves to be Marxists. And they disliked us enormously because they sort of felt that we were upper class and privileged. And so, whereas the children, there was no class differentiation. And so we were very much accepted by our peers and hated by the teachers.
I mean, suppose this is one of the things about being a kid is, I mean, when you're a child, you don't know about class distinctions. You just live where you live, and your neighbours are your neighbours. And the fact that you are rampaging through back gardens and leafy terraces and using Gloucester Carrot Crescent as basically your playground doesn't come into it.
Yes, the thing is that all of us, I mean, the children, we all went to the local state school. So, as I said, we didn't really know any different. And our primary school was literally round the corner. And it wasn't until I was 11, at which point we were packed off to either to the local secondary state school, or in my case, and several other kids in the street, because we had an interest in music. We were sent to what was then considered to be quite a radical and progressive comprehensive state school in Pimlico, which was quite a sort of trek across town to get to school. But it was a school of 1,600 kids, of which probably 100 were middle-class kids. And we were really deeply despised, and we were very, very brutally bullied by the other kids in the school. Well, they thought we were very, very different. And it wasn't really until that point that we realised we were very different.
So what was average family life then in the Miller household like? Were there people dropping by with, you know, new drafts of praise? Were there actors rehearsing in the back garden? Was Alan Bennett shuffling around trying to get rid of the lady in the van? I mean, how was it like? Because we have this sort of idea, and obviously ever since we've had the film and Bennett's writings, you kind of have this idea of this 60s boho sort of existence.
First of all, we never locked our back doors. So the parents all knew each other. They'd either been at school with each other or they'd been at university together. And so they were in and out of each other's houses having dinner parties and drink parties. And as I said early on in the book, they either wanted to kill each other or sleep together. And so there was this sort of, I mean, everybody knew each other in some way or other. And then the children were pretty much left to be feral and roam and climb over the back garden walls. And we would crash through the back garden doors of anyone's house that we chose to. So it was a very, everybody sort of was in this sort of melting pot. But one of the things I describe in my book is the sound effects in the back garden of Gloucester Crescent, which were the noise coming from every window of typewriters going at different speeds. And it's what I described as competitive typing. And I know my father in particular, who always sort of would sit in his study and would struggle to write, would be completely pained and humiliated by the fact that someone next door and beyond him and beyond there was typing probably faster than he was and getting either their plays or their reviews or their books out a lot faster than anybody else. And so there was this terrible rivalry. And you'd have a house where the typewriter was going like crazy, and then it would stop, and then there'd be a party to celebrate the launch of a play or the launch of a book or a review.
Sounds absolutely wonderful. Didn't you have, wasn't Alan Bennett in the basement for a while?
Yes, so Alan, when my parents bought the house from 1961. Alan and my father were performing in Beyond the Fringe in the West End, and Alan moved in as a lodger in the basement downstairs. And then in 1962, they went to America together to do Beyond the Fringe on Broadway. And when they came back, a couple of years after they returned to London, Alan bought the house across the road, which is the house that became famous by Lady in the Van. But what I should say is that Miss Shepherd, who is the infamous Lady in the Van, actually turned up in about 1969, and she actually lived on the street for the first 8 years.
So what was it, I mean, you also describe, because we're talking the 60s, and this is a time of, if you like, revolutionary change, big events. We've got the student protests, you know, the Vietnam War, and the moon landings. Were you, as a child, aware of this? And what was the reaction, were your parents saying to you, this, William, is going to be some serious sort of stuff, so we better watch this?
Well, the moon, as I describe in my book, it's an event that everybody wanted to sort of see and participate in, but it wasn't like, son, you're going to sit down and watch the moon landing. The watching of the moon landing was driven more that my brother and I really wanted to watch the moon landing more than my parents did. And it was a sort of chaos. It was my father, who always hated having the television on most times of the day, agreed to let us have it on over lunch. And so we could watch the moon landing live over lunch. And of course, the usual people who would just drop in from across the street or their friends were there at the same time. And we were struggling to watch the moon landing while they were sort of getting on with telling jokes and having a laugh.
You've split the book up into three different distinct parts. You've got, obviously, August 75, age 11, August 1980, age 16, and 1982, September, age 18. Why did you do that? Are you marking the passage of yourself and the passage of time?
Yes, I wanted to get, I mean, they're basically the three me's of my youth and the passage of time. The big sort of transitions for me were, of course, going from primary school to secondary school. And so I tell the first part of the book is told in my voice as an 11-year-old, which, of course, tells the story of my time around going to primary school. And the next is 16, having just spent 5 years at a state school, this school Pimlico in South London. And then at 16, I say to my parents, I'm sorry, but you either take me out of school or I give up and go and find a job, or you have to give me a dose of what you had. And so my parents packed me off to a boarding school in the country for the last 2 years. And so the last part of the book, I'm 18 and I'm telling the story of those 2 years, which were completely different and probably for me was the making of me and the time when I sort of rebuild my confidence and discover the person I am possibly today.
There's a passage in the book which is quite winsome. It's just about, you go back, I think it must be late 80s, early 90s, and the Crescent has changed because the atmosphere has changed and the children have moved on and the original residents have either moved on themselves or sold up or died.
Yes, so what I describe, it's really the 90s that I think in the 10 years of the 90s, I think the Crescent went through a sort of sad decline. And as I described, it's a little bit like a long-running play has come to an end and just a handful of people have been left to switch off the lights and take down the set. And it did seem very sad. There were no children. People had either died or they got divorced and moved on. And there were a handful, as I said, people like my parents who remained in the Crescent. And it seemed very, very sad, and it almost like there was tumbleweed blowing down the street. And then in about 2000, a sort of strange thing happened where I think people found that they couldn't find large houses in Primrose Hill, and the estate agents were saying, have you tried looking in Gloucester Crescent? And so families started buying up the houses and moving back in. And then in 2008, my mother happened to mention that there was a house for sale on the street, and I always said, I will never move back to Gloucester Crescent. And my wife said, I'm going to go and have a look at this house. And she fell in love with it instantly. And sure enough, I then woke up one morning to find we had bought the house three doors from my parents. So after 27 years of being as far away from Gloucester Crescent as I could in my early adulthood, I found that I was right back where I started, living in Gloucester Crescent, which was the point at which I decided maybe it was time to start writing a book about what it was like to be a child in this street.
I mean, three doors down from your parent, you must have had this crashing sense of, I mean, it's just come full circle, hasn't it, really?
Yes, and in a sense, there I am repeating what my father did, and that's why it was so important. I wanted to tell the story at the very beginning of the book of my father taking me up Primrose Hill, saying, you know, I've never gone very far. I've just gone in a big anti-clockwise direction around Regent's Park. And in a sense, I did a sort of bigger thing. I went a sort of anti-clockwise direction around the whole of London and found myself right back where I started. But it's been a huge success. I mean, moving back to Gloucester Crescent was probably the best thing I ever did. And here I am doing exactly the same thing with my children climbing over the garden walls to see their friends.
I was going
to
say,
nice to be back.
I was going to say, is that the thing? Do you get that feeling? Do you find yourself, because you've got this wonderful thing, so you find yourself at the corner of your eye seeing a small boy climbing through over a garden fence, and then you realise it's a cat, but it could in fact be yourself.
It is. I mean, and that was what was, that's what I enjoyed enormously about writing the book. It was like, it was revisiting someone who you knew very well and going back, and in fact that person was myself. And to spend time, I mean, it took me about 9 months to write the book, but to spend that 9 months with the younger me was a sort of interesting, slightly macabre, but also comforting experience.
What was the family and your former neighbours' reaction to the thought that you were going to write a book about the, you know, the mid 60s, the 70s, and to there on and you immortalise them in their private goings on?
Nothing but alarm. They were worried. I mean, I think the thing is that there have been, you know, Gloucester Crescent has been ridiculed in the press for many, many years. I mean, there was a cartoon strip by Mark Boxer called The Stringalongs, which was based on a sort of number of characters in the streets. And they were people who were quite clearly people who lived there, including my father. And then there was that Alan Bennett did a sitcom for the BBC in the 1960s that sort of ridiculed the absurdity of this community. So it's always been, and I think Private Eye had a column that used to be called Life and Times in NW1. So it's always been a sort of figure of fun because people from outside have never quite understood it. They've looked in from afar and thought that there was something sort of absurd about this community of people. But it's, you know, it's a wonderful place to be. And actually, I think when I moved back, one of the things I realized was that, I mean, you know, I was in my 40s when I was able to buy a house in Gloucester Crescent, and I had to remind myself when I was writing the book that actually my parents were in their 20s and their friends were in their 20s. So it was an extraordinary thing, really, for these young people who'd had very early success with their careers who were able to buy these big houses.
The book is called Gloucester Crescent, Me, My Dad and Other Grown-Ups. It's by William Miller. It's out now on Profile Books. William, if people want to find out more about yourself or the book itself, I mean, is there a website? Do you do the social media thing? Do you tweet on a regular basis?
I do. I have an Instagram account called Gloucester Crescent _the book. I've also set up, if you were to search William Miller on YouTube, I've actually edited down a number of clips which sort of give you backgrounds to some of the stories. I mean, one of the things that was great in writing the book was that there was an awful lot of information about my father and lots of videos of my father and interviews with him and his friends on YouTube. And I was able to aggregate those together and put them into a place where people could get more information about the book on YouTube.
I mean, begs the question then, William, what's up next then? What have you got next in your sights?
Well, I'll wait to see whether someone asked me and suggested I do write another book. But what I didn't say is that at the end of the book, the conclusion to the book is that at 18, I feel I have to get away from the Crescent and I have to get away from my father. And I literally run away. I fail my A-levels. And the next day, I go down to the travel agent and buy myself a one-way ticket to New York and leave. And when I arrive in New York, I find that, in fact, it's actually Gloucester Crescent on tour. So yeah. There's a sort of expat community, expat Gloucester Crescent community in New York who form a sort of support structure for me. So, I'm quite keen. I think if the opportunity came up, I would probably write about my time in New York and the sort of absurdity of being just another Gloucester Crescent in New York.
The book is called Gloucester Crescent, Me, My Dad and Other Grown-Ups. It's by William Miller. William, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at AbilityChiro.com.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.